So, Hogan, you've been a guy who has always been on the receiving end of questions from the media. You ever think about what it would be like? Well, you used to do that too, but these days at the White House, you ever think what it'd be like to be sitting there in the audience firing questions at the White House press secretary?
I've only dreamed about it, Tim.
Yeah.
If only that could be a reality. You think you could help make my dreams come true tonight?
Well, I don't know. I mean, we can talk to somebody, though, who knows a little bit about it, and we will do that in just 1 second. But first, please like and subscribe and do all the things, because this is the Line Drive Podcast. And so who do we have with us today but White House correspondent, the chief White House correspondent for Newsmax, James Rosen. James, thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate your time, as always.
Great to be with two friends.
Yeah, awesome. Great to have you with us, and thank you for agreeing to be on here. And you're the chief White House correspondent for Newsmax, but you are also a noted author, and everybody has to call you a historian, right? Now, you've had several books, including this most recent one, which came out in March, I believe, Scalia, Rise to Greatness, 1936 to 1986, by James Rosen. You see it there. If you're watching on Rumble, you can see the cover. Tell us a little bit about this book.
Well, you're kind to ask. This is volume one in a two-volume biography of Antonin Scalia, the late Supreme Court Justice. This book, which came out in March, chronicles the first 50 years of his life. It ends with him sitting down in his seat on the Supreme Court. So volume two will cover the Supreme Court years. Scalia is not only one of the most important justices of recent times, he's really one of the most important Americans of the last 100 years. And this book, Scalia, Rise to Greatness, tells the story of how he reached the pinnacle of his profession of American law with a vote in the United States Senate of 98-0. And that tiny imperfection, the fact that two senators didn't vote, bothered Scalia, who was committed not just to excellence, but to perfection, for the rest of his life. As late as 2005, when he was serving on the Supreme Court for 19 terms at that point, he could still be heard telling students visiting the Supreme Court, let's make it 100.
That's funny. Yeah, I guess, man, if you're a guy like that, maybe something like that does stick in your craw. I mean, if you've made it to the very, very top of your profession, what self-critiques could you have left, really?
Yeah, I'm willing to experiment with that kind of perfection myself, but I'm unlikely.
But James, you actually knew it, right?
That's right.
You had meals with him. You kind of got to know him over the years as much as you can know a Supreme Court justice, I guess.
Yeah, and that's really why this book exists, because when I first came to Washington in 1999, 30 years old, brand new Washington correspondent for the Fox News Channel, one of the first things I did was write to Justice Scalia to seek an interview. This led to a lengthy correspondence between the two of us that was frequently amusing, that went on for about 2 years. I'll be quoting from that correspondence in volume two. And it also led to a pair of lunches that we had, just the two of us, one-on-one each time, at his favorite place, which is a long-gone Italian restaurant called the AV Ristorante Italiano. It was a very modest restaurant with like fake plastic grapes on the walls. And it was located in what was then a fairly sketchy neighborhood of Washington. And we broke bread together. We drank wine together. He made me eat off of his plate. I said, Mr. Justice, like, he said, come on. So now I'm 30-year-old me is shoveling Antonin Scalia's vegetables, Justice Scalia's vegetables, into my mouth. He even drove me back to my office at Fox News on Capitol Hill both times in his car. And I want to let you both know that through my research, having interviewed classmates of Scalia's from the 1950s who participated in road trips with him for debate tournaments, all the way up through my interviews with Supreme Court clerks in the 21st century, being a passenger in a car driven by Antonin Scalia was as unnerving an experience as it proved for me. And there's only so much I'm even allowed to say about it. But one clerk, when I mentioned that I'd been a passenger in Scalia's car on two occasions, said to me, God help you.
So he had a bit of a reputation, I'm guessing.
Yes. Amongst intimates, yes.
Yeah, how about that? That's really funny. Well, congratulations on the book. I hope it's doing well. I hope it continues to do well.
Thank you.
And we are appreciative of having such an esteemed author and historian here with us today. But in your other job, which is that of White House correspondent for Newsmax, chief White House correspondent for Newsmax. You lob questions at people like John Kirby and Karine Jean-Pierre on a daily basis. And here's a couple of them. This one, the first clip is you asking a question of John Kirby, and it's you're reading to him that as we get to the clip, it'll come in at the tail end. You're reading what is now the infamous text message from Hunter Biden to his Chinese business partners, threatening them and saying that he was sitting in the room right that very second with his father, Joe Biden, who was at that time the vice president of the United States. And then the second clip in this is doing something similar to the White House press secretary. Hang on a second.
Here waiting for the call with my father, unquote. So just a couple of questions about this. First, does this not undermine the president's claim during the 2020 campaign and the reaffirmations of that claim by his two press secretaries since then, that he never once discussed his son's overseas business dealings with him?
No, and I'm not going to comment further on this.
Let me save you some breath.
If you're going to ask about this, I am not addressing. I know you do more than I'd like you to have. I am not going to address this issue from this podium. I'm just not going to do it. Thanks, guys. Have a great week.
That turned out to be false. Are you sorry about that?
I'll see you tomorrow. Come talk to me. I'll see you tomorrow.
So there, in that one there, we chased both of them off the podium in both of those instances. What, watching those, and I'm sure that's not the first time you've seen them, what describe your relationship, if you would, with the White House communication staff. What do you see as your role, how they treat you, what for the folks at home who don't live in this kind of world, what's that all like?
So this is not my first stint as a White House correspondent. I covered the White House for Fox News from 2000 to 2005, the last year of Bill Clinton and the first 4 years of the Bush-Cheney administration. I was always the number three of a three-man crew. So you had the number one guy, they're both now deceased, unfortunately, Jim Angle, who would think deep thoughts, cultivate sources, go to the briefing and prepare the package for what was then Brit Hume's nightly newscast. The number two guy, which is the late Wendell Goler, that person's job would be to do live shots on the North Lawn pretty much all day, starting in the morning. And the number three guy would be the person who would fill in for number two when number two would fill in for number one, and who would fill in for them both when Mr. Bush went to Crawford, Texas for long stretches. The role really hasn't changed in the sense that my job is to gather information and facts. There's a variety of ways of doing that, of which one of them is the White House press briefing, not always the most effective. And then to synthesize those facts in an entertaining and digestible way and report them to the American people. Really, I like to say, you know, when I talk to students who are expressing an interest in going into journalism for a career or studying it in college, I always ask them, well, why do you want to be a reporter? And you get the same range of responses usually every time. They range from, I want to help people, I want to help children, I want to be a voice for the voiceless, I want to speak truth to power. And I wind up saying that all of those are noble and admirable goals, but they don't have anything to do with why good reporters, honest reporters, become reporters. If you want to help people, become a social worker. If you want to help children, become a children's advocate. If you want to be, if you want to speak truth to power, write a column. Don't be a reporter. And if you want to be a voice for the voiceless, run for Congress. The only reason to become a reporter, the only reason that good and honest reporters become reporters, is because we care about adducing new facts to the record of our times. And the greatest compliment ever paid to a reporter that I know of was paid to my hero and late friend, Tom Wolfe, who is known for having written many contemporary classics, both in fiction and nonfiction, from The Radical Chic to The Right Stuff to Bonfire of the Vanities. On one of the back covers of his books, there's a blurb, I believe from Newsweek, where the reviewer said, no reporter has gotten more of his times down onto paper than Tom Wolfe. And that's really why you get into it. As for the relationship that I have, I would have to say it's less a function of my role, which has not changed, and more a function of the way I'm perceived or my company is perceived by the given White House communications operation that's in power at the time. And so with the current Biden White House. Let's just say I'm not their favorite reporter. Newsmax is not their favorite outlet. It's been difficult for me to work with Karine Jean-Pierre to get called on in the briefings. There are 49 seats in the White House press briefing room, seven rows of seven. Newsmax has the seat dead center in the six of the seven rows. And Karine Jean-Pierre, much like her predecessor, Jen Psaki, with whom I had a pretty good working relationship over many years' time, dating back to our shared time at the State Department in the Obama administration. But much like Jen Psaki, Karine Jean-Pierre labors under the misapprehension that the fortunes of the Republic or Joe Biden would materially suffer if she extended the questions beyond, say, the first 2 to 3 rows of the room. But I've made some headway with that, as you've seen in the clips that you played.
It's such a like perfect, James. You have such a great cadence. You're a very intellectual person, but you, the intellectual delivery, the calmness with which you ask your question, the sincerity, but also with factual information you use to pose the question, and people on this podcast know I was a journalist way back in the day.
Yeah, so was I, James.
In the late 90s, yeah. And so we kind of have a glimpse of a piece of what you guys go through on a national scale, a much bigger scale. But I found it interesting when I was in the White House and I was dealing with the people in that room, in essence, you had one or two that would ask some sincere questions. Newsmax was one of those outlets. I felt as though Fox did as well. And they weren't always easy, but they were substantive and they were what people actually cared about. And then everybody else in the room was doing their own thing, trying to make a name for themselves, be part of the story, which is a definite no-no. And got to be
he's talking about Jim Acosta.
That's one, but I mean, the room's full of them. Now it seems it's the exact opposite, where Karine Jean-Pierre is the press secretary, but everybody else in that room is a deputy press secretary on her behalf. It's almost as though they parrot the line and don't ask sincere questions. Do you feel any tension or mocking or people that around you that they're angry that you're actually trying to hold the administration's feet to the fire when you ask detailed, sincere questions? And if you do, do you even care?
Before I get to that question, Hogan, I feel compelled, first of all, to thank you for your very kind words and to ask if you might put them in writing. And secondly, to ask what the consistent ringing of that bell is. Are you cooking eggs back there, Tim? What's going on?
I think it's Hogan's email or something.
There's a way to like set it to like not.
Can't you just close the app?
It is. It is closed. It just keeps going off. And I don't know how to make it.
You can't even kill it off. Well,
I'm sure you can. I just don't know how.
Okay, as long as
maybe he was keeping score of different points you were making.
Yeah, that's right.
He was making
every time I use a $5 word, perhaps.
I'll take you with it while you answer my question.
So, I'm reluctant to comment on the motivations or my assessments of the motivations of my colleagues in that room. I'm friends with quite a number of those folks. I've known some of them for 20 years. I respect most of the folks in that room. I think that, you might ask different questions based on where you fall in the running order of that briefing. So if you're the first or second or third person to ask a question, your questions probably are going to be aimed at eliciting more facts about the story or two stories or three stories of the day.
Right.
Most of the Washington Press Corps operates under, from what I've seen, the belief that their mission should be to incrementally advance the given story or two stories of the day just a little bit and put a new headline on it. When you are called on 30 to 40 minutes into the briefing, most of those kinds of basic informational questions have already been posed. And so I've seen it as an opportunity when I get called on to cut through a lot of the sort of doublespeak or the answers that have been proffered to up to that moment, and to ask things on a deeper basis or a more direct basis, or in some cases, the questions that won't get asked. And so, for example, the clip you played where I read aloud in full the text of Hunter Biden's 2017 WhatsApp message to Henry Zhao, a Communist Party official, which was basically a shakedown effort in which the younger Mr. Biden mentioned that his father, the former vice president, was seated right next to him and, quote, we want to know why the fulfillment of the commitment hasn't been fulfilled. It was extraordinary to me that nobody else had asked that question, because that document, that WhatsApp message, had been released the night before by the House Ways and Means Committee. So it's an opportunity. I see it as low-hanging fruit. If others are not going to ask what are fairly basic, important questions that a lot of Americans want the answers to, then that's good news for me, because it gives me an open lane.
Much like, you know, I know you were there in 2020 and you did some excellent reporting on your own regarding Hunter's laptop and the different things and the open investigation into Hunter, right? Weren't you the one who broke the story about the potential tax evasion investigation that was going on with Hunter?
On October 29th, 2020, 5 days before the election, when I was working for the Sinclair Broadcast Group, I broke the story that Hunter Biden was under active FBI criminal investigation of finances. The Biden-Harris campaign said nothing. The FBI said nothing. DOJ said nothing. Hunter Biden and his attorneys said nothing. And aside from a mention the next day in Politico Playbook that I had reported this, there was no follow-up whatsoever from the press. I later spoke to members of the press, the sort of hardcore DOJ press corps that covers the Department of Justice full-time, as to why everyone was silent, and I got different answers about it. But that reporting held up because after Hunter Biden came forward to say, I'm under active FBI criminal investigation, and clearly that case is still with us.
Oh, I remember. I remember. And so as you look around, and we lived through that, Hogan and I did, as you know, on the Trump campaign, when no one outside of you and the New York Post, of course, who broke the story, and Fox News would touch anything involving the laptop. And I had reporters tell me privately, we begged them to write stories about it for the final 2 weeks. We had press conference calls with members of the House and the Senate and leadership on there, laying out all the different things that had been disclosed as a result of the laptop story. And a lot of them, some of them told me privately, look, you're not going to find any takers on this, because no one wants to be the one to break away from the pack. So do you find that, like you're saying, you sat there and you said, you're thinking to yourself, I can't believe no one has asked about this Hunter Biden WhatsApp text in which he incriminates his father as being part of the whole thing. Is it the pack mentality? What is it? Why is it that the press corps at large just decides as an organism to stay away from certain stories and just not cover them, which of course is the way they suppress these stories from being disseminated to Americans?
I would suggest that there are a number of motivations at work. Undoubtedly, some number of the members of the White House press corps are totally ideologically driven and want to report stories that are damaging to Republicans and helpful to Democrats. Some others were put off by the ick factor of Hunter Biden's laptop. Some others, I think, are adhering in their own minds to what they perceive to be a kind of old school standard where the president's family is off limits or what have you. Perhaps some just never got the assignment or what have you. But again, I'm reluctant to ascribe motivations to these people. They're my colleagues, they're competitors. And is there a pack mentality? Yes. And it can work in the other direction. So when I questioned Admiral Kirby about that WhatsApp text, which you played that clip, after Admiral Kirby left the room, Peter Baker was sitting in the New York Times seat in the White House press briefing room. Peter Baker is the sort of unacknowledged or unofficial dean of the White House press corps. He's been covering it for a long time. He's written several books about each of the presidents. He gets the cooperation usually of the presidents and their vice presidents, including Mr. Bush and Cheney. And I think Peter's a good guy and a good reporter. And when Karine Jean-Pierre took the podium, he followed up and said, well, Admiral Kirby didn't answer James's question. It's a reasonable one. Are you going to answer it? Was the president involved when he was a former vice president, some kind of shakedown attempt? And Karine dodged and weaved, as you might expect. But then several reporters from those front rows, whom we might ordinarily imagine to be sympathetic to the Biden administration or what have you, the subject of our discussion now, followed up on Peter's question, and Karine in the end faced 6 minutes of questioning on Hunter Biden on that occasion. So the pack can run in a variety of different ways. One last point I'd like to make. What story was most responsible, would you say, for Hillary Clinton's problems in the 2016 campaign cycle?
Oh, well, it was the emails and the servers.
Fact that while Secretary of State, she was using a private, unsecured email server installed at her home with off-the-rack security protections up in Chappaqua. That story was broken by the New York Times, right? So there is a profit motive involved in journalism as well. And I suspect that when reporters get a good story on their hands and they think it's going to please their bosses and it's going to be big news, they probably don't even care whose ox is getting gored, as long as, you know, it means more airtime, book contracts, and fancy parties for the report.
If it's a topic that they just can't ignore. But, you know, I think sometimes if Newsmax is doing a story, and as we saw with the laptop, if the New York Post breaks it first, or if it's a Fox story first, or, you know, if it's somewhere like in the identifiably conservative press like Breitbart or something like that, that makes it, I think, as a press communications operative, it makes it exceeded. That raises the barrier even higher, I think, for it to jump over into a place like the New York Times, you know, because I think a lot of times the press corps will look at a thing and say, oh, that's just the conservative press that cares about that. Yeah. We don't need to know about it, and we can safely ignore it. And they don't even consider it as a story because of where it began.
I can give you an example. That's my impression. Yeah. Just last week, I broke a story. Or was it earlier this week? Gosh, no, it was last week. It was about 2 years ago, I think, the Daily Mail, the British outlet, that broke the story that while he was vice president, Joe Biden was making use of pseudonymous emails. Right. Emails where he's not using his own name, but names like Robert L. Peters, J.R.B. Ware, and so on. At least one of those pseudonymous email accounts was a .gov account, right, which already puts it in a different category from Mrs. Clinton, who was using an unsecured server and so on. And all that was 2 years ago that we learned about that. But this resurfaced about 10 or 12 days ago because Chairman Comer of the House Oversight Committee sent a letter to the National Archives demanding access to the unredacted portions of those emails and all documentation that the archives has in its possession relating to those email accounts. Once that story broke, and that was widely covered because it was a public official release from the chairman, a source of mine in the intelligence community got in touch with me and showed me the screen grabs and other means by which this individual was able to uncover and confirm the entity that hosted the domain for the Robert L. Peters.gov account. And I was able to report for Newsmax on air that entity was a unit of the Defense Department, the Defense Information Systems Agency, or DISA, which, when you look at DISA's mission, its own stated mission in its own literature, its mission is to be a combat support group, and they use lots of fancy IT terminology, but basically to support the warfighter in cyberspace and to protect our cyber infrastructure from attacks. Now, they say on their literature that they work with people across the national security apparatus in the White House and elsewhere, but the Vice President of the United States has no statutory duties or authorities relating to the armed forces except to nominate candidates to the service academies. So the question is properly raised as to why this elite warfighter combat support agency of the Defense Department was setting up a pseudonymous email account for the Vice President of the United States so that he could conduct business on that account, including discussions of Ukraine, where his son, Hunter Biden, was CC'd on at least two of these emails within 19 days of each other. And the email address for Hunter Biden that was used was his Rosemont Seneca address, which is not secured at all. Of course, my efforts at getting some comment out of DISA and the Defense Department proved unavailing. But the point is, nobody picked up that story. Now, if the same exact scoop about who hosted the Robert L. Peters domain were broken with the same exact writing and verbs and adjectives by one of my colleagues from the so-called mainstream media, I have every confidence it would have been picked up in Politico Playbook and perhaps led to follow-up reporting by other organizations. In this case, to your point, Tim, it did not.
Right. This is one of the things that infuriates me, and it's such a great point, because it's almost as though the accepted elite standard bearers are the only ones that trigger that lemming response, okay? Think about, and you guys showed a bunch of examples, we've been talking about it, but Joe Biden has a grandchild no one will acknowledge until the New York Times writes about it. And then all of a sudden it becomes a story, right?
Right.
It's anything as sad and as heartbreaking as an illegitimate child, but it's also as serious to national security and, you know, the very fabric of this nation as the story you just point out with fake names and fake email accounts that go directly to the vice president. It's almost like they're the ones who have to write about it. But I'm going somewhere with this on a source issue. You mentioned some of the sources you go to. How do you feel is the best way to cultivate these sources? And also, have you ever run with a story where a source kind of burned you on something? And can you share that experience?
Well, first of all, good sources, I think, gravitate toward reporters whom they see doing good work, number one. So the best way to cultivate good sources is just to be a good reporter. But there's a lot that goes into it. For example, when I was covering the State Department for Fox News on and off for 10 years, I always made it a point to dress in a certain way. There are certain men who like to dress in a very flashy, sartorial, splendor style, and maybe one of those is participating. I don't want to embarrass Tim Murtaugh, you know.
I thought you were talking about it.
But sure, I always found, because I was dealing with people who are GS-10s and 12s and 13s. These are a lot of them career bureaucrats at the State Department. I would literally dress like a bureaucrat. So that what is the goal of a reporter cultivating a source? To get that person to give you information. And by the way, a source is anyone who gives you information. It could be totally on the up and up, calling a press secretary and getting the date of something that's about to happen. Or it could be someone, as has happened for me, that you don't even know, strolling by the park bench in Lafayette Park, where you have agreed to be at a certain appointed hour, and handing me a manila envelope and continuing walking.
Wow.
I've met a source of the watch. I've actually met a source.
So I've done it all.
But so the idea is to cultivate people to get them to give you information. In a lot of cases, it's actually against their own interests to give you that information.
Right.
And whole books have been written about this, the ethics of journalism. But I find you get good sources when you do two things. One, when you demonstrate a track record of good journalism. And secondly, the late, great Tom Wolfe once said, the reason there are so few great British reporters, he said, is because it's simply too undignified a profession for them. He said, there's lots of great British essayists, okay? But when you're a reporter, basically what you're engaged in doing is rattling your tin cup and pleading for information. And I've always found the best way to cultivate sources is to cultivate the idea, even if it's a delusion, even if you don't have the goods, but it's better when you do have the goods, to cultivate the notion in their minds that this is going to be an exchange of information. So that when you leave the message, and when you're a reporter, even your friends and your relatives don't want to answer the phone. You're really a man without a country. I've always found it's better to leave a message instead of saying, hey, NBC News is reporting X, can you help me match that? It's better to say, hey, I've come across a piece of intelligence about subject X that's of interest to you, the bureaucrat or intelligence community official, whomever that I'm calling. I'd like to run it by you. And if you have that track record behind you, that source thinks twice about blowing off the call. They know that you probably do have some information that it's best for them to figure out and learn what that is. So they call you back. Since we're here, if we have the time, I'd add one more element to this.
Yeah, go ahead.
Please.
I mentioned to journalism students when I speak to student groups, etc. There's a line in a De Niro movie. Oh gosh, I think it's Heat. I can't remember which one it is, but it had the late great Ray Liotta in it. And Ray Liotta says to another character at one point in this movie, to get down Broadway, Freddie, you don't go down Broadway. Okay. What he was saying for New Yorkers like myself who know this about the city, if you want to get from way uptown and take Broadway all the way down to get down to lower Broadway, it'll take you forever. You're better off darting over to the West Side Highway or the East River Drive and taking one of those highways down and then coming back into the city to get to lower Broadway, right? When you're covering an institution, let's say the White House, especially if, as we've already established in my case, the press operation is hostile to you, unfathomably and unnecessarily, but nonetheless unmistakably, rather than rattle the tin cup, you want to cultivate the idea that you have information they need to know about. How do you get that information? It's not been going to come from the White House. So you have to leave Broadway and go someplace else and then come back into Broadway. Where is that other place? Well, usually it's Capitol Hill, where there's 535 members and they're all talkative, okay?
Yeah, right.
If you're covering the State Department, you're going to go to the Pentagon, where there's this ancient and enduring antipathy between those two institutions. If you're covering the Pentagon, go to State. And then you get your information and you come back down into lower Broadway and you place that call and you say, hey, I have come across some information I think you'd want to know about. And that's how you cultivate sources. As to your question about whether a source has ever burned me, nothing comes to mind immediately, but I'm at this so long, it's quite possible I might've forgotten something.
Right. Maybe so. What's the biggest frustration that you have right now? It doesn't necessarily have to do with the personnel that are in the White House now or the administration or the ideological bent of the administration. Not necessarily that, but what day to day, what's your biggest frustration when you go to work and you have to deal with? Is there something that keeps popping up, something that frustrates you consistently?
The fact that I'm not called on with regularity that briefing, it makes it very difficult for me to do my job in that briefing. It's very unfair. I am accredited with the White House Correspondents Association for 20 years or so. I've had a hard pass, a White House hard pass, which is the badge you swipe at the Secret Service guard points to get onto the grounds, to get onto the White House complex. And I have a Newsmax has an assigned seat in that briefing room. So I'll understand if you don't call on me in every briefing. I'll understand if you don't call on me for two or three briefings. But to go 6 or 8 months without being called on is very frustrating. And you've seen how
6 or 8 months?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Wow. So
in January of 2022, on January 19 of that year, as you recall, it was leading up to the invasion of Ukraine by the Russians. President Biden gave a news conference in the East Room where in a display of generosity, but not necessarily political savvy, he decided to extend the length of that briefing by another hour and to call on every single person in that room. And so I was grateful for that. And when my turn came, again, over an hour plus into the briefing, so you're not going to ask the incremental advance the story by 6 inches types question. I wanted to get at what I think is an important question, something that bubbles throughout the political discourse, but no one had asked the president about. And to this day, I'm the only reporter to ask this question of President Biden. I said, Mr. President, James Rosen with Newsmax. And if you look at the video, you can see upon hearing those words, I look off to one of his aides when just staring daggers at, how did this get in this room?
Right.
Maybe the vice president remembers that I was the reporter during the Obama-Biden administration that the FBI spied on.
No joke.
I would be maybe unwelcome on that basis, too. I said, Mr. President, James Rosen with Newsmax, I'd like to raise a delicate subject with you, but with utmost respect for your lifetime of accomplishment and for the high office you hold. A poll was released this morning by Politico Morning Consult, which found 49% of registered voters disagreeing with the statement, Joe Biden is mentally fit.
Oh,
I wanted to laugh and try and fluff it off. I said, not even a majority of Democrats, only 43%, was willing strongly to affirm that statement. At this point, he tried to cut me off. I said, Mr. President, if you'd allow me to finish. Why do you suppose it is that such large segments of the American electorate have come to harbor such profound doubts about your cognitive fitness? Thank you. Now, I knew we wouldn't spend a whole lot of time on that terrain.
Sure.
But his answer in total was, I have no idea. And then he moved on to someone else. And the very answer in many people's minds validated the question, because when you say, I have no idea, you are, in a sense, speaking to a mind that is empty. And the price I paid for that question was not to be called on for 8 months.
Well, I think it's a price worth paying because the question was good. And I don't know if you practice your phraseology before a question, which would be an interesting question to ask you, which I'll get to. But I have a real, Tim and I have our own little axes to grind with different reporters in different situations, obviously. And I'm sure you have yours to grind with various officials. But what I feel as though curiosity has somehow died in journalism. And we've talked somewhat about this, but when you go back and think of a James O'Keefe, Project Veritas grainy video, or an email between Fauci and someone in Wuhan lab, stuff, or emails between execs at Pfizer and things like that, the Hunter Biden laptop, of course. If you had told me as a journalist, or Tim for that matter, and we did talk to Miranda Devine about this too, but if you told me you had something like that, I would have been over the moon that I got like a nugget like that. I would have run it. I would have promoted it. I would not let it go. A dog with a bone situation. It's almost as though the press corps, for whatever reason, and look, I know people in that room too. I'm not trying to have you get in their heads. But it just feels like, as you said, there's incrementalism on a big story. But that I don't know if it's long form, but no one really cares about, it seems like, the issues that the American people care about, or exposing somebody or some corporation or something doing wrong. Do you get that sense at all? I mean, I feel it because I guess I fight the battle every day. But, you're in that room. Do you feel the curiosity is just dead?
The irony here is that all of the different presidents feel completely victimized by the very press corps that we're discussing, right?
They're all wrong.
Their different ideology. I remember reading a poll report from when President Obama greeted Prime Minister Netanyahu at the airport, I think, once. And the poll report described a brief exchange between President Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu. Netanyahu referenced the fact that with them was the Deputy National Security Advisor, Ben Rhodes. And Netanyahu further referenced the fact that Ben Rhodes' brother is David Rhodes, who at that time was the president of CBS News. And Netanyahu said something to the effect, well, that must be a nice situation for you, Mr. President. And Mr. Obama said back to him, have you seen how CBS News covers me? Okay, so here was Barack Obama upset with CBS News' coverage.
Yeah.
We all feel victimized by it. I'll give you one more example from my own experience about how different press corps function. And we talk about pack mentality and the other motivations driving these people. So when I was working for Sinclair in 2019, this was during the hearings that were being held by the House Intelligence Committee preparatory to the first impeachment of President Trump. And I decided that I was going to attend the weekly news conference of Speaker Pelosi. Okay. I've done a lot of work on Capitol Hill. I've never been a Capitol Hill correspondent per se. So I'd never really attended the Speaker's news conference. And I did it twice in November and December of 2019. And the first time I asked this question of Speaker Pelosi. Now, Speaker Pelosi, like Joe Biden, is a nonlinear speaker. They're always, and same with former President Trump, they start and stop their sentences. They're very difficult to transcribe. Someone like Condoleezza Rice or Hillary Clinton was very easy to transcribe because they spoke in lawyerly terms and so on.
Right.
Sentences. Pelosi goes through her nonlinear sort of scattered opening statement, and now it's time to call on the members of the press. And she called on me first. I was sitting right in the front row, and I don't know why she called on me first. Maybe because I was calmly raising my hand, and I had a pleasant face, and I was new to her, right? And I said, Madam Secretary, we hear it said often, and of course it's true, that impeachment is not a legal process, but a political one. And yet I think we can also agree, and at this point, if you watch the video, you see her look off to her head as if to say, who let this into the room? And I said, and yet I think we can also agree that the impeachment process carries many of the same accoutrements that we see in the legal process, in the legal world, from the assistance of counsel to the threat of perjury, subpoenas, etc. I said, this was all demonstrated most vividly to my eye in yesterday's hearing, which had been the one with Marie Yovanovitch, when the chairman, Adam Schiff, reminded the minority that he would do everything in his power to protect the legal rights of the whistleblower to anonymity in that case, at which point the speaker, Ms. Pelosi, said, right. So I said, so I'd like to ask you, Madam Speaker, if you can explain to the American people why it is in this quasi-legal political process that the legal rights of the whistleblower should prevail over those of President Trump, who ordinarily would enjoy a Sixth Amendment right to confront his accuser. Now, was that a respectfully asked question? Yes. Sure. Was it a reasonable question? Yes. What kind of question was it? It was a question where I was asking about two competing legal claims in a non-legal setting and why one should prevail. And frankly, it was one for which the speaker should have had a ready answer. Her answer to me was, well, let me tell you, Mr. Republican talking points, Republican talking points, as if the Sixth Amendment is a talking point for the right wing.
Right, okay. Right.
So I come back 2 weeks later, and I decide this time I'm going to sit right in the front row. I'm going to be early. I'm going to get prime seating, which I do. This was December 5, 2019. A young man in his early 20s comes up to me while everyone's setting up their cameras and milling about, getting ready for this news conference with the speaker. And he says, I'm sorry, can you tell me which outlet you're with?
Oh, yeah.
Sinclair Broadcast Group. He said, thank you. And he, you know, off he was, right? And nobody else did I see him ask who their outlet is. Speaker comes out. She gives her non-linear opening remarks. And everyone starts clamoring. Now, I have to tell you about this press corps. We're talking about the Capitol Hill press corps now. And some of the most famous people in it are Manu Raju of CNN and a number of others, Chad Pergam of Fox News. And what I had observed, not only was the same incrementalism that you see at the State Department press corps or the White House press corps, but they were literally asking Speaker Pelosi the same question, literally the same one question, three times over these two briefings. And that question was, what is your message to vulnerable Democrats in swing districts who don't really want to take on impeachment of President Trump at this time? And she said the same answer all three times, which is, we are not whipping this. This is a vote of conscience, etc. Okay.
That's pretty good.
It's pretty embarrassing, by the way.
Yeah.
So anyway, I raise my hand. She looks right at me, and then points away from me. And this happens several times. And it's clear she's just not going to call on me, and I'm not going to get my chance to ask a question. The question I wanted to ask was, Madam Speaker, President Trump and Representative Doug Collins, who was the ranking member on Judiciary at that time, a staunch defender of President Trump in Congress and during the impeachment saga, they have alleged that this whole process has very little to do with the Constitution, but rather with a certain animus deeply held on their part for the president. So let's clear that up. Do you hate the president, Madam Speaker? But I didn't get called on. So she goes through the rounds with the incremental questions, and she leaves. And the exit where she left in that room was right near where I was seated. And I was forced, as I am sometimes in the White House briefing room, because you don't get called on, to practice the art of interjection, to project your voice loudly enough to seize on a brief opening when you'll get your words out, when there's a bit of silence. And
so
and,
that's a James Rosen way of saying shout a question.
Shout a question and be succinct. And be succinct. Yeah. Pith. And so I just yelled out at her, do you hate the president, Madam Speaker? And you may recall the response. Speaker Pelosi wheeled around, started pointing at me. Memes that were later created had lightning bolts coming out of her finger at me. and she said, how dare you accuse me? And I said, I didn't accuse you of anything. I asked a question. So she marches back to the podium. The cameras are going crazy. And she says, President Trump is a coward. And she starts to light into him in those very personal terms, which showed that, in fact, she very much hates the president and me. And at the end, she ended by like a minute and a half long tirade by saying, so don't mess with me, and storming off a second time. Within 48 hours on eBay, you could find 30 or 40 different varieties of T-shirt and hoodie that had pictures of the two of us with the back of my head with the words, don't mess with me, emblazoned, or don't mess with Nancy. You'll be surprised. Mm-hmm. Nothing in the way of remuneration from all of that merch and swag. But again, what you saw was a press corps that A, was practicing incrementalism, and B, sometimes was asking the very same question, literally, and eliciting the very same response three or four times. And so it offers an opportunity to the reporter who can distill the essence of what we're talking about and come away with a great moment and probably what was the most electric moment of that whole impeachment saga.
Amazing stuff.
You love being the skunk at the garden party.
You asked about this earlier, and yes, I have had that room in the White House press briefing room groan at my questions. Like when I asked Karine Jean-Pierre if the president is woke, I heard the groan.
Yeah, how's it going?
You know what? Some of the same outlets whose reporters were groaning audibly in my direction after asking that question, a week later, we're still doing think pieces on a reporter for a conservative outlet asked, is the president woke?
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
When you look back, because you are, like you said, you're in the middle seat in the sixth row of seven, when the camera pans to you, and then they start on a wide shot, as you probably know. Right. And then, James, are you rubbing up against a microphone or something? Do you know? Is that
right now?
It could be. It seems like there's a lot of background sound on the microphone.
There's a fan going because it's super hot in this office.
Ah, that's probably what it is.
So late at night that they turn off the air conditioning.
I'm sorry, that's so much noise.
A jacket for this one.
Sorry. So. Last question, then we'll let you go because we're coming up on 45 minutes here, past 45 minutes. So when you start your question, the camera starts on a wide shot and it slowly zooms into you. I know you've seen this before, and so you're front and center there. And when you're asking your question, which is clearly going to make KJP or someone uncomfortable, still in the shot are, you know, five or six of your colleagues sitting around there. And man, when because nobody phrases a question like you do.
Nobody.
You're going through this question and you're setting it up, and you know that there's just a great hard hitting question at the end of it. And the looks on the faces of the other reporters who are in the shot are so fantastic. It's like every one of them had some bad eggs at lunch or something. And they have this terrible look on their face, like they'd rather be anywhere else but sitting near the guy who's asking this, you know, unauthorized question, as it were. Can you sense that? Do you feel that energy around you when that's going on?
Yes. Yes, I can. The other problem, though, is that because I'm in the sixth row, the cutaway camera that zooms in on the reporters asking the questions in the briefings will find that James Rosen is often blocked by some lurch figure who has planted himself right in front of me. And a lot of times some of my best stuff, you know, you can't even see me because of lurch one or lurch two. And so I become a disembodied voice posing those questions. So you learn, as a TV performer, to angle your body this way or that to make sure that you will be seen. I mean, you want your work to be seen. And all that comes with that, the aforementioned book parties and book contracts and the attention of Hogan Gidley and all the rest of it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's you put Hogan last. That's awesome. Need to flip that list. Yeah. Okay. Hogan, last cracks here. You got anything else for James?
No, I really appreciate the time, and I appreciate the work you do. And you know, a mutual friend of all ours, Joe Piscopo, I'm on his radio show, and I can't go on there without him mentioning you about the great work you do. And I say this, James, not because I've known you for years now. I mean, I've got Carl Cameron's pager number in my phone. That tells you how long I've been doing this.
Campaign Carl and pagers. Jeez.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So again, this isn't to blow smoke. I appreciate your curiosity in a briefing. I appreciate you, as you said here, not trying to further the same story, but finding a different story that people actually care about in this country. And they can care about two different things, don't get me wrong, but I just have always appreciated that. And of course, I think you're pretty funny. You're witty. Pithy is always a word I'd use to describe you too. So I just want to thank you for coming on this podcast and also kind of sharing the inner workings of what you do, how you do it, mentalities of reporters. Cause so many people we talk to, Tim and I both, are just so angry at the media. You know, their popularity sits somewhere between Congress and COVID. So they don't have a good reputation. So I just appreciate the work you do. I really do. I always have. So that's just
thank you both.
It was to me.
An honor to be on Line Drive Podcast with two good friends. And when I come back and do my next appearance on this podcast, maybe we can find time for my Trump impersonation.
Oh, yeah. Well, how much time do you need?
That's a good tease, right?
That's a good tease. We'll hold that for the next time. So we do want to thank you, James, Chief White House Correspondent for Newsmax, James Rosen, and also I'm going to pull up the cover of your latest book, again, Scalia, Rise to Greatness, 1936 to 1986. Available, I presume, everywhere, Amazon and all of your major booksellers, James?
That's right.
Yep. Yep. And it's the go to the Young Rosen College Fund, I'm sure. So
anyone who doesn't buy the book is stealing from my children, in essence.
Yes. Yes. Always the best way to sell that. Yes. So we appreciate your time, James, and thank you for stopping by, because this has been the Line Drive Podcast.